Hello, I'm Stephen Cole, and welcome to Season 2 of the Answers Project podcast from CGTN Europe, where we try to find the answers, or at least make sense of, some of the trickiest questions facing us in this increasingly complicated world. We've got access to some of the best brains on the planet to see if they can help shed light on some of the most pressing ethical, scientific, geopolitical, and philosophical quandaries. And I'm joined by wonderful Mari Beveridge, who's going to help me unravel this week's question. Mari, what are we asking this week?
This week, Stephen, we are asking, can we ever beat poverty?
As ever on the Answers Project, we only address the big issues. It's a huge question. I imagine the answer is not going to be simple. And why did you choose this question?
A couple of reasons. We've been talking about poverty for a long time and it still hasn't been resolved. And it feels like that there should be a way that we can resolve it. But also the last 2 years of the pandemic have really undone a lot of the progress on poverty alleviation. So I think it's a particularly pertinent time to talk about it.
OK, so where to start? And as in the best podcast, we need to define our terms. What is poverty?
So the World Bank organisation is really the sort of authority on this, and they describe poverty as hunger. Poverty is a lack of shelter. Poverty is being sick and not being able to see a doctor. Poverty is not having access to school and not knowing how to read. Poverty is not having a job, is fear for the future, is living one day at a time.
So that's the definition using qualitative data. What about quantitative? Can poverty be measured?
Again, according to the World Bank, anyone who is living on less than $1.90 a day is living in extreme poverty. And anyone who's unable to afford basic food, clothing, healthcare, shelter, and that currently is 689 million people. As a percentage, that is 9.2% of the global population.
So almost 10% of the people living in the world are classified as living in extreme poverty. It's a huge number. Do we have any details on the demographics? Who are the people behind the numbers?
So children actually account for two-thirds of the world's poor, and women represent a majority in most regions, but we'll come to gender parity a bit later on.
And geographically, which regions are suffering the most?
In recent years, extreme poverty has become increasingly concentrated in sub-Saharan Africa. About 40% of the region's people live on less than $1.90 a day. And in the Middle East and Northern Africa, extreme poverty rates nearly doubled between 2015 and 2018, from 3.8% to 7.2%.
And I presume that's the result of the crises, the wars in Syria and Yemen.
Yeah, spot on. And unfortunately, since 2019, these numbers have got much, much worse as a result of another enormous issue that I mentioned earlier, the COVID-19 pandemic. It has had a catastrophic impact on global poverty alleviation efforts.
So how far has the pandemic taken us back?
Well, to explain its impact, I want to go to our first guest, Achim Steiner, the administrator of the United Nations Development Programme.
Well, I think in a generic and global sense, you can say without any hesitation that it is a major setback. Depending on where you live and what country you belong to and what kind of social protection systems were able to be mobilized, the impact on poverty has been differential. Now, clearly in the low-income countries across the world, where very little social protection exists, we have seen massive increase in poverty, also in extreme poverty. The numbers going well beyond 100 million people who have already been thrown back into poverty. In Latin America and the Caribbean, for example, UNDP recently published a new human development report for the region, and we estimate that the setback has really taken us back 13 years to the year 2008, when we last saw these kinds of poverty levels.
Well, that's very bad news. 13 years of progress undone by the pandemic.
Yeah, it's really, really shocking. And according to the World Bank report on projected poverty impacts of COVID-19, between 71 to 100 million people are being pushed into poverty just as a result of this crisis, with the majority of the new extreme poor being found in South Asian and sub-Saharan countries, where poverty rates are already really, really high. And in 2021, over 143 million people slipped further into poverty.
And is that on top of or including the amount of people already living in poverty?
So this is in addition to. So these new poor will join the 1.3 billion people already living in some form of poverty who saw their pre-existing deprivations made worse during the pandemic.
And in terms of protecting and helping the world's poor during this global crisis, how did we do on that?
Well, here's Achim Steiner again.
You know, historians will one day judge how badly or how well the world came together around COVID-19. I think we have to be fairly honest that in the first 6 to 12 months, and I think to many this is also understandable, I think the early experience of COVID-19 will not be remembered as one of the great moments where the world acted rationally and with wisdom, but rather in reflex, under pressure, and obviously to some extent even in panic mode.
The impact of COVID-19 has been the hardest on people who, for generations, have lacked equal access to public goods and services, quality healthcare systems, and strong social protection. So it makes it harder to cope with any shocks.
And that multi-generational poverty is known as the cycle of poverty. Is that right?
Yeah, so poverty is often described as a trap. For someone to get out of poverty, they need opportunities like education, they need clean water, medical facilities and financial resources. And without these basic elements, poverty becomes a cycle, as you say, from one generation to the next.
Well, that makes sense. If families are too poor to send their children to school, their children will have a very difficult time trying to earn an income when they grow up. And if a community lacks clean water, women will spend their day gathering water instead of working, instead of bringing in money. If medical facilities are far away, a parent loses income every time they take a sick child to the doctor.
Absolutely. It all has a sort of knock-on effect.
And bringing all those factors back into the issue of COVID, I imagine the measures imposed to limit the spread of the pandemic have pushed the poor further, deeper into poverty. The informal economy, which enables many people in poverty to survive, was, I suppose, virtually shut down in many countries for months.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. On this, I want to go to another guest who I spoke to about jobs in relation to poverty. His name is Guy Ryder. He's the Director General of the International Labour Organization. And he oversaw a report that was released in 2021, which looked at how the recovery process is likely to go throughout 2022.
Well, 2020 was the biggest crisis in the world of work in modern times. To give you some sort of comparison, the impact on jobs and incomes was about four times greater than in the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Looked at that way, we're digging ourselves out of quite a deep hole, I'm afraid. And what the report we're launching today looks at is how the recovery process is likely to go. And looking forward from here to the end of next year, the end of 2022, I think the message is that the recovery, though important, will be incomplete. We won't be back to where we started from. But perhaps even more important than that is the unevenness of this recovery. Some are going to do quite well, others are going to have a very hard time of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. He mentioned the inequality and unevenness of the recovery. So who's pulling the short straw?
Well, it's women in particular who have been disproportionately impacted by the pandemic. You may or may not be surprised to hear that women have lost their jobs in significantly larger numbers than men.
Right. Why is that? Or why, how come?
Well, here is Guy Ryder again to explain.
Firstly, because they are segregated and concentrated in those sectors which have been hardest hit. Secondly, because often they're on relatively insecure employment contracts, so it's easier for them to be shown the door in the first instance. And thirdly, as you've indicated, they've had to pick up those care responsibilities at home. When schools close, when the kids need looking after, women invariably pick it up. And what is worrying, I think, in particular, is that 9 out of every 10 women who have moved out of their jobs during the pandemic have actually left the labour force. They're not unemployed, they're inactive, as the economists would say. They're simply not participating anymore. So the question becomes, how and will these people come back, these women come back into the labour force?
Mari, what our experts seem most frustrated about is that the world was doing relatively well on alleviating poverty before COVID, wasn't it?
That's right. Absolute poverty rates had fallen faster in the past 30 years than in any other time on record. And the impressive fall was actually the result of changes in just two countries, China and India. China in particular has done a pretty impressive job with this.
That's right. China's President Xi Jinping announced last year that China had met a long-awaited target of lifting the entire country out of extreme poverty by 2021.
Yeah. According to the World Bank, China has brought over 800 million people out of extreme poverty since launching economic reforms in the 70s. The national benchmark used by the Chinese government is slightly higher than the $1.90 a day poverty line used by the World Bank to look at poverty globally. For some insight on how it's calculated in China, I spoke to journalist Luo Liming, a reporter from China Radio International, about how the poverty line is calculated there.
So the definition of the current poverty line, so that was set in 2011 and is 2,300 yuan in annual disposable income per capita, which is roughly $1 a day and looks like a rather modest goal. But 10 years later now, that 2,300 yuan is worth 4,000 yuan at the current price level, and we've already shot through that target. The per capita disposable income of the rural poor increased from 6,079 yuan in 2013 to 12,588 yuan, or nearly $2,000 in 2020.
So those are the numbers. I hope you had your calculator out, Stephen. What I found really interesting when chatting with Liming was his personal perspective and how he had seen the face of poverty transform in his lifetime in China.
My hometown has been transformed in the sense that previously it was a small basin tucked away in the mountains and it was remote and we didn't have a lot of interaction. The first time I got on a train was the age of 18, 17 actually, when I had to leave the town and travel to Shanghai to study in the university. And I remember the markets, the fairs actually, the farmers markets, if you travel there, it's always stinky, and the commodities, especially the bananas, they were black, you know, they were not fresh. And then in recent years, when I had a chance to travel back home, I was glad to find out that people were using smartphones and we could spend money on fresh vegetables. And vegetables were sort of something we take for granted because we were rural and we had fresh vegetables, but fresh fruits, we didn't grow them locally. So to see them displayed at the fruit stands was something that I wasn't familiar with when I was a little boy.
And you're absolutely right, Murray. Seeing the face of poverty, you said, transform in his lifetime and in such a short amount of time. It must have been incredible for him to see that sort of change in his lifetime.
Yeah, absolutely. And Achim Steiner, who we heard from earlier, says China's success with poverty really comes down to two factors.
I think the words priority and choice sum up very well, you know, the story of poverty reduction and eradication in China. Priority was given to addressing not only the modernization and industrialization, which clearly became the economic engine of China's remarkable economic growth and development over the last 30 years, but from very early on, there was a strong commitment to also deal with poverty eradication and to address those who were not living in the shiny new big cities being built in the industries around the urban centers, but also to deal with those living in the rural economy and the rural areas of China. And leaving no one behind is something that has been integral to many of China's development policies. It was given a priority and development choices were made. And so China's record in lifting people out of poverty, literally hundreds of millions of people over just two or three decades, is without precedent so far.
Yeah, certainly without precedent. Certainly without precedent in so short a time. So earlier we heard about the realities and difficulties of extreme poverty. Feels like we've entered the solutions phase of this episode, bringing us back to the exam questions. Can we ever be poverty? And if yes, how?
So, There are a few key areas to look at when it comes to trying to solve this problem. Tackling hunger, granting access to education, funding innovation, reforming agriculture, creating jobs, management of natural resources, and growth policies. So China and India are really, really good examples that have done well to reduce their extreme poverty numbers through measures just like those.
So other countries could take a leaf out of China or India's book.
If only it was that simple. A lot of Asian countries have had success in tackling poverty through mass migrations of rural workers to big cities to work in big factories. But there just aren't really the same opportunities in parts of sub-Saharan Africa where almost half of the world's poor live.
And why is that?
There's a number of reasons. Even though poverty numbers are dropping, the population has boomed and will continue to. And there is just a lack of infrastructure, a lack of public transport. The transport links aren't great. And there's limited access to essential services.
So what can be done? We've already heard how we can't afford to leave poorer countries behind.
No, and that's exactly what Guy Ryder, who we heard from earlier, was saying. He says that we need to look at the issue of fiscal space. He explained that the $16 trillion US dollars that the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, tells us was spent by governments worldwide to deal with the economic and social fallout of the pandemic, he says it's been spent by rich countries on rich countries. Here he is again.
We really cannot leave the less developed countries to fend for themselves. There have been some modest attempts to suspend debt servicing, but I think we have to be very worried that if the developing world, I'll use the phrase rather generally, is left to its own devices and debt stress is already increasing, then we're going to get into a bit of a mess here. So I think in terms of issues like special drawing rights at the IMF, we need to take care of the fiscal space in the developing world. Plus, and I think we can consider that health policy today is economic policy. Now, we really cannot tolerate a situation, not just from a moral, but from a self-interested perspective, a situation where, you know, many parts of the world are doing very nicely in developing vaccines and getting them into the arms of their citizens, but, you know, to the exclusion of others. And that is going to become not just a moral health issue, it's going to become an economic and development issue as well.
And that's a crucial argument. Richer countries are vaccinating, or most of them, and poorer countries are not having the same kind of access to vaccines. So it's a rich versus poor, vaccine-friendly, and people who are at risk from the pandemic. And we can't leave developing nations behind. But what I think is interesting about the poverty conversation is that so often it focuses on poorer countries without recognising that rich countries have unacceptable levels of poverty too. And I say unacceptable because they often have the means to help their poor and should be holding themselves to a higher standard. And I'm thinking in particular of the United States. As of 2019, 10.5% of the population, which is about 34 million people, have been living in poverty. Now, I'm not sure how these numbers are calculated, but nevertheless, it's still a staggering number.
So I actually looked into this, into the American numbers, and the measurements are based on income and a person's ability to meet basic needs. But when looking beyond income to people experiencing deprivation in health and education and living standards, 1.3 billion people in 107 developing countries are multidimensionally poor, according to a 2020 report by the UN Development Programme.
So what does that mean, multidimensionally poor?
So, multidimensional poverty acknowledges that poverty isn't always just about income. Sometimes a person's income might be above the poverty line, but their family has no electricity, no access to a proper toilet, no clean drinking water, and no one in the family has completed a certain amount of years at school. I think it's around 6 years.
I think it's important, Murray, to acknowledge that poverty is such a nuanced issue, and there are so many variables, like access to food and water.
Yeah, hunger is a huge part of this conversation that a lot of our guests kept bringing up. And unsurprisingly, a significant battle to be won in the fight against extreme poverty. And here I'd like to bring in our next guest. He's the Deputy Executive Director of the World Food Programme, Amir Mahmoud Abdullah.
Hunger is, in principle, probably one of the world's most solvable problems. It's one of the world's largest problems, but it's the most solvable. But to attain it, you need to remove so many of the drivers. The conflict and climate crisis, they are really drivers that can't necessarily be solved by an input of food assistance and food assistance alone. So we have to work together with many other actors. Key amongst these are political actors who can hopefully create the conditions for peaceful and political resolutions to climate, to the crises, for the climate crisis.
It struck me, Mari, that he said it's one of the world's most solvable problems, but also one of the largest. So how can that be?
It's really complicated, as we've heard. In October, David Beasley, the head of the UN Food Agency, tweeted a sort of tongue-in-cheek congratulations to the Tesla founder Elon Musk for reportedly earning $36 billion in a single day. He said, a sixth of your one-day increase would save 42 million lives that are knocking on famine's door. And Elon Musk replied, if the World Food Programme can describe on this Twitter thread exactly how $6 billion will solve world hunger, I will sell Tesla stocks right now and do it.
And did he?
Unfortunately, no. Beasley did invite Musk to meet anywhere, and he said, Earth or space, to discuss the potential donation, but Musk has gone silent on this. But I think he's trying to make the point that you can't just throw money at a situation to solve it. Though I would argue $6 billion would help.
It certainly would. I certainly think, too, that large donations should go towards long-term solutions that address, as always, the root causes of both famine and hunger. For example, teaching farmers better techniques, encouraging people to grow crops to sell, making sure countries have a stronger social safety net to meet food needs in times of crises.
Yeah, it's a great point. Teach a man to fish, etc. Now, you've raised the issue of climate change there, maybe without even meaning to. It's something that the World Food Programme's Ahmia Mahmoud Abdullah, who we heard from earlier, also raised as an important part of the poverty debate.
With this climate crisis comes in some areas, you've got extended periods of drought, so that people farmers are relying on rain-fed agriculture. They can't afford huge irrigation systems, so they're relying on rain-fed agriculture. The drought comes, the rains stop, then they'd lose their crops. We saw this happen in southern Madagascar recently, which has been pushed into famine. That's one of the few which was not conflict-driven. That was purely climate. Then you've also got the other side of the coin is that you suddenly get rainstorms and floods that wash away crops or wash away the soil that was needed for the next season's crop.
So he's saying it's not always conflict that's driving poverty. Climate is an enormous driver, set to get worse, and the best way to tackle these issues is with science, is with innovation.
Yeah, and innovation is how we're beating COVID, and I'm sure it's how we'll beat poverty.
I agree. And on the subject of innovation, here is someone who will definitely agree with you. I spoke to the world's first ever chief scientist of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, Ismahan Eloafi.
My job is to make sure that science, technology and innovation, it's at the center of everything we do at FAO. So I'm hoping that with the chief scientist being a new position within FAO, is that I could support FAO in achieving its global mandate, and particularly end hunger, eradicate poverty, and reduce inequalities through science, technology, and innovation.
Ismahan Eloafi says she can't really see another solution to poverty other than innovation at the moment.
We have the same playing cards, but we need to play better. How do we play better? We play better only if we use science, we use technology, and we use innovation. And when I talk about innovation, it's really a broad innovation. It's not only technological innovation. It's partnership innovation. It's financing innovation. It's business model innovation. How do we do things? So I think really, because we are at a turning point in history, particularly with COVID-19, that shows us how fragile is our system, how interconnected we are, how much we need to change our agri-food system, we can't do it without science, technology, and innovation. And that's really what I hope I'm bringing to FAO and to its member states.
What I keep hearing, Mari, is that solutions revolve around interconnectivity and, as always, global cooperation.
Absolutely. It's often shrugged off as a cliché, but really that sentiment was echoed by nearly all of our guests. Eradicating poverty can't be done without partnerships. Eloafi told me that the UN's Water Scarcity Programme made real changes to the lives of impoverished people, and it thrived on cooperation between countries.
The leadership of FAO in developing the Water Scarcity Programme really allowed the countries to come together, to understand how their issues are similar, and they could work together, not only because they have underground or surface water that is between their borders that they have in common, but also because they have similar ecosystem and they could help each other by trading between them, by doing research together, by working on similar policies and making a synergies between the different policies. So there is several examples of how FAO have really worked, be it on forestry, be it on fisheries, be it on natural resource management, be it on climate change. There is different examples that really made a huge impact on the ground.
I think my main takeaway from that has been there's no quick fix, no one size fits all. The first step to ending extreme poverty is by identifying what's causing it in a particular community and then deciding what needs to change. Because poverty often looks different in various places and it's caused by different factors. The work to eradicate extreme poverty varies depending on the context.
I agree. I also think it's kind of incredible what countries can do when they prioritise eradicating poverty as a key goal, as we've seen.
And if we are to beat poverty, essential services and infrastructures always need to be improved with new schools, medical clinics, and access to clean water.
And people need more economic resources to help boost their income so they can better provide for themselves and for their families. And the work must be sustainable, no quick fixes. What we've heard today tells me that the community must be involved in each step.
So, can we ever eradicate extreme poverty, Mari? The UN estimates that to do so, the total cost per year would be about $175 billion, which is a big sounding number, but it is in fact less than 1% of the combined income of the richest countries in the world. And somehow as a planet, we still haven't managed to do it.
No, and absolutely no help from the world's billionaires either. Elon, Jeff, if you're listening, it's time to cough up.
Sometimes I don't think they are. Mari, thank you very much. We're hoping you, our audience, will get in touch to tell us what you think. Is the world doing enough to tackle poverty? That's the question. And can it ever truly be beaten? Let us know. And if you have a question you'd like answered, we'd love to hear from you on the next episode of The Answers Project. Find us on CGTN Europe's Facebook or Twitter page. You can also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or Spotify. Thanks so much for listening.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.